So, this is the voice note for Thursday, April 16th, for the reading in Inanna, Queen of Heaven and Earth, The Descent of Inanna. The story of Inanna's descent has correlates in other mythologies you may be more familiar with, the descent of Persephone to the underworld and her mother Demeter's search for her, also the death of Eurydice and her lover Orpheus's effort to rescue her from the underworld. Both of those Greek myths, of course, that had elaborate cultic practices surrounding them. Dumuzi has many correlates as well. He is what the Victorian author and anthropologist Sir James Fraser called the dying and rising god. Figures to whom Dumuzi bears at least a passing resemblance include the Green Knight, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, Dionysus, the god of wine. He's associated with the grape stock. If you've ever seen a grapevine, you can cut the grapevine all the way back down to a stump in the earth. And in spring, it will spring forth with new green and soon grow so luxuriantly that it covers and buries your fence, your other plantings, your car, your driveway. I say this having watched the behavior of my neighbors. Dumuzi's most surprising cousin, though, is Jesus Christ. We just celebrated, or observed others celebrating, the death and resurrection of the Son of God, Jesus Christ. Consider that Christ comes among us with a proposal of new and renewed spiritual life, is put to death, and in the early spring is, by divine power, brought back to life. One understanding of the figure of Jesus Christ is that he is a descendant of the dying and rising gods with which the ancient Near East was full to overflowing. If that sounds outlandish to you, like I'm just making too much of a coincidental resemblance, consider as well that Jesus Christ, in the 3 days between his death and his resurrection, journeys, according to Catholic theology, to hell, a period of his story known as the harrowing of hell. He's reputed, while down there, to have saved the souls who had died righteous, but could not journey to heaven. So, death, a hell journey, and then rebirth. The period that Christ spends in the underworld, the harrowing of hell, is named for an agricultural implement. A harrow is an agricultural instrument used in the cultivation of a field. So, turning to the poem itself, one question here, and I'm probably going to ask you to talk about this in your small groups on Thursday, is why? Why does Inanna open her ear to the great below? Why does she decide to leave everything she knows and is queen of behind to journey to this place that is hostile to her, inimical to her? She gives an explanation to Nettie the gatekeeper to be passed on to her sister. Oh, I'm here to observe the rites, the funeral rites for your brother, for your husband, the Bull of Heaven. I don't think that goes too far as an explanation. It may or may not be true. It could be a feint, a dodge. It could be legit. But even if it's a reason that she's headed there, it's not the reason that she's headed there. How might we read into the deeper layers of the myth to learn what motivates this harrowing journey into the unknown and the unformed? One hint may be, in the first three lines, from the great above, she opened her ear to the great below. From the great above, the goddess opened her ear to the great below. From the great above, Inanna opened her ear to the great below. Ear, in Sumerian, also means wisdom. The ear is the seat of wisdom. How does the poem change if we read wisdom where ear is printed? From the great above, she opened her wisdom to the great below. From the great above, the goddess opened her wisdom to the great below. From the great above, Inanna opened her wisdom to the great below. So one way into her motivation, into the deeper layers of the myth, may be in that double meaning, ear and wisdom. I think it's also important that she adorns herself or protects herself or prepares herself by donning seven of the may, which in this poem are garments, remembering that the may are the powers of civilization. Can we infer more about what her motive is, what her mission is, from these acts of preparation? And I'll leave it to you. What other moments in this poem can we look to for hints, clues, cues, keys to what is going on for Inanna beyond her stated reason for this road trip? Having just read you the intensely repetitive opening three lines, I'm brought back to the question, what is up with all the repetition? What is it here for? The listener's just not trusted to get it the first time, or even the second time? Or is there some meaning or purpose behind all of these reiterations? Remember, these poems, which we read on the page in a literature classroom, were not originally intended for silent, solitary reading and literary appreciation. These were poems that didn't just say something, but did something. These were liturgies, hymns, but in story form, meant to make contact with the divine figures whose stories they were relating. So there is a religious purpose to them, a spiritual purpose. And in having a spiritual purpose, the work needs and wants to affect, I could even say alter, the consciousness, the form of awareness of the listener, the participant in the rite. So as you encounter these repetitions, take them in. Read them out loud to yourself and see how they sound in your ear, see how they resonate in your body as you articulate the sounds. There's not a lot of new meaning in a repeated line. The words don't change much. But something may happen on a nonverbal physiological plane that's important to the effect of the poem. Poem probably wants for us to identify with Inanna so that we're not just reading about her journey to the underworld, but participating in her journey to the underworld. We, in a sense, become Inanna. And the whole time I've been recording this voice note, there has been a doe and her fawn in my backyard munching away at the flowers on my blackcurrant bush. Whether that has to do with Inanna, I do not know, but it seems like it signifies. All right, so Inanna's motivation, the role of the repetition in inducing states of mind or consciousness in a reader or participant in the poem. The last thing I want to draw your attention to is the minor characters in the poem. The figure of the Galatur and Quirgara and the Gala demons. I'm curious how you picture them and how you experience them. We get certain details about them that set them at a distance or a remove from ordinary human social interaction. The Gala have no mothers or fathers or brothers or sisters or children. They eat no food, they take no drink, they accept no libations. They do not participate in the usual give and take between the human realm and the divine realm. And the Quirgara and the Galatur, what details do we have about them? They are created from gunk scraped from underneath the fingernails of the god of the sweet waters, Enki. What do we make of that? What is the gunk under the fingernails of the god of the sweet waters? Why would that be good raw material for these mysterious creatures? They are creatures neither male nor female, so they don't participate in the usual Sumerian gender binary, and that seems to give them unusual powers. They can enter the underworld like flies, and they have a capacity for empathy and or deceit, depending on how genuine you think their commiseration with Erish Kegel is. But they get the job done, and they get it done well. They play her. They play the queen of the underworld, which is not a safe game to play or an easy game to win. Last thing I'll note, then, is that these two are like flies, and they are essential to the rescue of Inanna. An actual fly is crucial to the rescue or the discovery, the recovery of Dumuzi. So what's up with the little pesky bug-like creatures showing up at these crucial moments in this sequence? What do you associate a fly with? And what's a fly got to do with a fertility myth? All right, I will leave you with that. And I will see you Thursday afternoon on Zoom.